Welcome to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before today's episode, we'd like to remind you, as always, that you can subscribe to our YouTube channel at Lungcast to get updates on new episodes and interview segments. You can find and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast players, and you can even get more Lungcast episode-related content at hcplive.com and lung.org. Today we're running a special episode outside of our regular programming. It has officially been 60 years since the 1964 Surgeon General Report, an historic contribution to not only clinical research, but to our understanding of the impact of cigarette smoking on users by way of increased risk and exacerbation of pulmonary and cardiovascular diseases. To commemorate this landmark development in public health advancement, I was invited by HCP Live to reflect on the Surgeon General Report with Viet Le, an Associate Professor of Research and Preventive Cardiology Physician's Assistant at Intermountain Heart and Vascular. Through our cross-specialty discussion, Mr. Le and I discussed the myriad of cascading effects delivered by the 60-year-old report, how it affected respiratory and cardiovascular care strategies, how it influenced modern public health efforts, and how its resonance is even felt in our current work to curb the mitigative impacts of vaping. We hope you enjoy this special episode.
Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, pulmonologist and Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. I'm here today with Viet Le, a preventive cardiologist. Thank you for joining us. We're here to take a deep dive into the nuanced intersections of healthcare, research, and the ever-evolving landscape of public health. This January, we happen to be celebrating the 60th anniversary of the 1964 Surgeon General Report. And that'll be the topic of today's discussion. For those who do not recognize it simply by name, the Surgeon General's Report is among the most pivotal moments in public health in U.S. history. It was delivered by Dr. Luther Terry, and the report brought to light the dangers of smoking as a significant contributor of respiratory and cardiovascular disease. No single issue has preoccupied the Surgeon General's office more over the past four decades than smoking, as we'll talk more about today. This report alerted the nation really for the first time to the health risks of smoking, and it transformed the issue from one of just individual and consumer choice to really one of epidemiology, public health, and risk for smokers and non-smokers alike. Today's conversation, we're going to break it down into three key parts, each unraveling layers of significance. So we're going to kick off by briefly diving into the impact on public health in the U.S. in the last 60 years. So I want to ask Viet, can you talk briefly about the impact of this report from the standpoint of someone in preventive cardiology?
Yeah, you know, since we've been tracking cardiovascular deaths, it's been astounding how quick the rise, the velocity of rise into cardiovascular deaths have been in the early part of this past century. And really, that can be almost directly attributable to smoking. It's quite fascinating, if not terribly just scary, that when you look at the statistics, and I would point here to folks that are interested, of course, there's a new 2024 report out, but the heart disease and stroke statistics that's put out by the American Heart Association shows a wonderful, wonderful graph. Again, a little bit scary to look at, but from the beginning of the past century up to 1960, that rise has been meteoric. And then this report comes out, and you see that just the short, you know, time afterwards, which speaks to further down as we talk about the public health aspect of this, when that report came out and societies picked up on this, and we immediately went on really a full offensive against smoking, the decline was astounding. Down to 1980, 20 years later, you see this peak and then this drop. So we went from a million deaths, cardiovascular deaths a year, down to about 800,000. You'd say, well, that's still a lot. And I would agree with that. But that was quite the 20% reduction in cardiovascular deaths, which again, I think is directly attributable to smoking. Now, that's starting to rise from other factors. It's just one of those things that we look at least from the preventive cardiology side, The American Heart Association talks about the essential eight, and smoking is one of those things. So, you know, if you smoke, stop. But if you don't smoke, don't start. And I think that this is really when we think of, like, what does this really mean? Well, of course, cardiovascular deaths, you can't quite walk back from death when it happens. But there's years of life attributable to disability. And then there's years of life that are attributable to premature death. And smoking has kind of topped those charts, both in 1990 and looked at again in 2019. And, you know, through that space and time, even from that going forward, so I said 1960 to 1980, but going from 1990 to 2019, smoking has, enjoyed a further decline by about 50%. And, but still tops number one in terms of years of life, affected disability and death wise. So I think this is an important piece for me as a preventive cardiology, practitioner. I talk about smoking quite a bit. In Utah, the rates are a little bit lower than what we would expect, but it's kind of astounding across the United States still. This is something we need to focus on. But I'm just amazed at one Surgeon General report and its effect nationally. So thank you for that. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss how this affects preventive cardiology and cardiology in general. Now that we've uncovered the historical echoes of that report, let's shift our focus to part two, where we explore the successes of anti-smoking campaigns and the broader implications. So Dr. Rizzo, could you enlighten us on the strategies that made these campaigns so remarkably effective?
Sure. And at first, I'd like to go back to the impulse for that official report on smoking and health. And that came about back in actually 1961, when the American Cancer Society, American Heart Association, the National Tuberculosis Association, which later became the American Lung Association, and the Public Health Association of America, all addressed a letter to, at that time, President Kennedy. And they called for a national commission on smoking and wanted to dedicate this to seeking a solution to the health problem that would interfere the least with freedom of industry, but also in the happiness of individuals. And that's a quote from that letter. So, yeah, while the report proclaimed that cigarette smoking is a health hazard of sufficient importance, and you just mentioned that importance led to a lot of changes, it really didn't come up with appropriate remedies. It mentioned that we should have them, but those remedies were not outlined. So it really did fall to public health organizations, some of which I just mentioned, to become advocates to lawmakers. And for that reason, in 1965, Congress required cigarette packages distributed in the United States to carry a health warning. And since 1970, these warnings have been made in the name of the Surgeon General. Also in 1969, big legislation for decreasing cigarette advertising on TV and radio was banned, and that became effective in September of 1970. So that's just a measure of how citizens working through public health organizations who advocate and speak to lawmakers can make a difference. And since that time, these same organizations have continued to advocate in multiple spheres of public health. And we're going to talk about some of the parallels, but these messages are really important because these messages have to be based in science and trust. And we know that since the pandemic, mistrust in science and disinformation on the internet and other sources have been rampant. So the right message, the right time, the right individual, and more importantly, being given by the right messenger is what these advocacy organizations have to do. And that's important because there are many of the underserved populations, Black, Hispanic, American Native, where they're not as used to getting the message from typical white scientists wearing white coats. So we have to be aware of that. And for this reason, we have to get the message across about the smoking harms. And similarly, things such as vaccinations. We know that there's science behind why people should get vaccinated. It's a public health issue. If you don't get vaccinated, you can spread the disease, let alone also be impacted by the disease itself. We also know that mental health has been an issue, especially around stigma. And interestingly, smoking has had a stigma with it over the years. Now it's hard to find somebody who's diagnosed with lung cancer. The first question somebody asks is, oh, did you smoke? We know that smoking is not the only reason people get lung cancer, but that stigma sticks with the individuals. And even our healthcare providers still have a stigma and a nihilism around the cigarette smoking individual. Another place where we've had to put a lot of public health initiatives is around climate change and environmental health. things such as the EPA came into existence as a result of knowing that there was bad air quality and looking at the science behind and the epidemiology of death related to poor air quality. And that became, back in 1970, the Clean Air Law. So again, these are examples of how public health agencies work together, not only one at a time, but work together across their missions in order to make things happen. So I think at this point in time, we'll move to part three. And I'd like to go to, I guess, vaping would be an issue we could talk about.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing that I feel like we had a handle on the messaging, at least for combustibles and for smoking and cigarette smoking. But here in this new era of e-cigarettes and vaping materials, it's been a tough thing as I look at this in my patients. So I'll just point out also, and this kind of comes back to part one, but boy, when you get on top of smoking, the reduction in events is so astounding. I can't state enough that just smoking itself, cigarette smoking, increases risk by almost double for both heart disease, so what we traditionally think of as a heart attack, but for stroke as well. So implementing those things that you spoke about in part two, in these public health measures, just placing these smoke-free laws has led to reduction in events. But now we have this vaping story that's come up. And it's just too early to tell from a cardiovascular standpoint. I imagine acutely, things can be seen from a pulmonary standpoint, from the lungs. But from a cardiovascular standpoint, the fuse is a little bit longer, if I may use a lighting analogy. And so we haven't really gotten a handle on just how much risk. I suspect that we will see these events and that they'll start to stack up. On the acute side of things, how does this change aerobic capacity? We have seen a report at the American Heart Association scientific sessions, even as, far, I guess it's not that far back, but in 2022, where folks have been seen to have an impact on their aerobic capacity. So this is stress testing. If you did vape versus those that did not, it did impair their aerobic capacity. And so time will tell to, see how much this affects downstream risk. So I'm curious about your take on this from the pulmonary standpoint. Sure.
No, you bring up a good point that there's both acute and chronic effects. And if we kind of look at tobacco and lung cancer, we know it takes probably 20 years on average, maybe a little longer for a smoker to develop lung cancer from smoking. We know that vaping has really only been around in this country maybe 10, 15 years to the extent that it has been. So we don't have long trajectory as to what happens with chronic smoking or vaping. And we also have the problem that vaping is not the same. One vape is not the same as the other. Cigarettes, at least, were standardized to some degree. We knew the 7,000 chemicals were in there. With vaping, you don't really know what's in those containers. So not regulated by the FDA. We don't know how much nicotine is in them. Some of them have much more nicotine than would be even safe in most regards. So we just don't have evidence to show that chronically these are safe. Acutely, as you mentioned, we know that it causes inflammation in the airways. We know individuals with asthma and COPD most likely have flare-ups if they inhale any irritant, whether it's a traditional cigarette versus an e-cigarette versus vaping. We also have to remember there was the EVALI episodes where vaping led to a hospitalization and ventilatory failure back before the pandemic, probably related to some contaminants related to a vitamin E acetate. So the unregulated nature of the e-cigarettes makes it almost a Russian roulette as to what to do in the long term with the vaping. But we really have a dilemma a bit because there is the harm reduction theory. And depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, the United Kingdom, for example, looks at e-cigarettes as, quote, safer than regular cigarettes and, in fact, promote them in many ways as a smoking cessation device. Taking the hard line of the United States, the American Lung Association says you should quit, don't switch, because we just don't know the consequences of long-term e-cigarette use. And we know that millions of cigarette smokers quit. They work at it 10, 11 times to try to quit, but you can quit. And we offer not only counseling, but there's 7 FDA-approved medications to help an individual quit smoking. So along with recommending the smoking cessation medications and counseling, we know people can quit. So that's the message that all of our tobacco-free kids, American Lung Association, American Heart Association, American Cancer Society are all in it to say that, you know, e-cigarettes, we don't know the answer to the long term. So don't smoke. Don't start smoking. If you are smoking, quit. So yeah. I think that's the message from a pulmonary standpoint.
No, I would agree with that from preventive cardiology. I'm glad you brought up that the harm reduction theory here. And I would say I'm not as militant, but I use it as a way to then discuss, can we use those seven products, one of those seven products to just quit entirely any nicotine products. And I think that's something that we need to get better at in the cardiology space. It's in our guidelines. We, have it as part of cardiac rehab. And it's something that we just need to get better at in the cardiology space. I don't know in the pulmonary space if our specialists there, probably have fewer touches, I'd imagine. But from my standpoint, I think we need a little bit more education for our colleagues as to what that looks like, how to implement those. And actually, that we're probably underdosing folks on things like varenicline. I stop a little bit too soon and don't recognize just the dosing strategies that work the best for them. But yeah, I would go for a full abstinence. But at the same time, I do recognize that at least switching provides some safety from the combustibles, but I don't think we stop there.
Right. That's a great point. So I think our listeners can feel like we could go on and on about this. We have a lot of issues to talk about, but I think we'll stop it at that point. We talked about the harms of vaping, the importance of public health issues, and certainly as an individual, get involved with a public health organization, be an advocate. It's very easy sometimes to be an e-advocate. You sign up for emails that help your congressmen and senators vote in the direction you want them to on certain bills. So thank you for listening today. Hopefully you can go to hcplive.com for some other pulmonology, cardiology, and public health information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening, and to our friend Viet Le for his time and insights. We'll be returning to our regular Lungcast schedule with a new episode in the next 2 weeks. Perhaps further down the road this year, we'll return to the topic of the historic Surgeon General report. In the meantime, you can go back to our episode on the health effects of e-cigarettes with Dr. Kevin Walton, originally published in June 2021. In the meantime, you can go back to our episode on the health effects of e-cigarettes with Dr. Kevin Walton, originally published in June 2021, to learn more about tobacco-related health issues pertinent to today. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo with the American Lung Association, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.